Accession number 34596.
Reel 3.
Reel 3. So, which squadron did you join them as a crew?
Well, because we had three New Zealanders and three group had a New Zealand squadron, that's why we went there. It was primarily because there were three New Zealanders.
And what was the squadron?
75.
So this is the... Am I right in thinking that this is the primary New Zealand squadron, the one that had existed
yes.
since the start of the war?
Mm-hmm.
Where were you based?
A place called Meepo, which is about 6 miles from Ely.
And what was the airfield like?
Bleak, flat, as Cambridge here is. The airfields, like everywhere else in the east of the UK, were so close together that once you were airborne, you could see at least two or three other bomber stations. And in fact, of course, that was one of the problems, particularly later in the war when we had so many aircraft, was collisions, particularly nighttime, of course.
And was it a wartime constructed airfield?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Most of them were, yeah. Yeah.
So what kind of accommodation did everybody have there?
Well, there were Nissen huts, mostly. Usually two crews. I think that was one of the things where personality and how you felt came into it very much because, faces that you saw on the squadron, suddenly you didn't see them anymore. And you know, you carried on. But when you both crews go off, as we did on one occasion, on a daylight raid, and when we got back to our hut in the late afternoon, the other crew, all their bedding had gone and all their everything had gone, so they'd obviously got the chop that being daylight someone had seen them go. That really does sort of get to you a bit, which is inevitable, of course.
So, in a sense, with the accommodation, you share it as a crew, do you?
Yes.
So officers and sergeants together in
No. The officers are separate. They have their own accommodation as well as their own mess.
So it would be you sergeants?
The sergeants, yes.
And were there very many facilities on the airfield? Because I assume that with the wartime constructed ones, there was less facilities than you might get with the sort of like regular stations.
Oh, absolutely. Difference chalk and cheese. serving on a peacetime station after the war was over, one can, you know, it was first class accommodation compared with what we had. Spread out, needed a bike to get around anywhere, lots of mud, and of course, particularly at that time of the year, the autumn and winter, bleak.
And were the aircraft out in the open most of the time?
Yes.
You mentioned obviously in the autumn and winter. When did you actually join the squadron?
I joined the squadron in October of 44.
If you can sort of take me through as well, when did you start operations with them? As you joined in the October, did you start operations right away, or is there a sort of working in period?
Almost right away. Almost right away, yes.
And I take it at that stage you were involved in nighttime and daytime operations, were you?
Yes, we did a mixture of both. Some of them, I can remember particularly the first one because it was on a target in Holland, and having a Dutch father, I thought it rather quaint that my first visit to Holland was dropping bombs there. On a German gun emplacements which covered the entrance to the Scheldt. So although the troops by that time had got to Antwerp, they couldn't use the port because they couldn't get the entrance, so they had to get rid of these guys at the Volkeren Island. And that was a daylight raid, quite low level too.
When you say low level, what kind of heights were you operating
at? Well, that would have been about 6,000-7,000 feet.
So I take it in that case it's quite a greater threat of anti-aircraft fire as well?
Well, the light air, when I say light, this is a word for, you know, short range aircraft, anti-aircraft fire was very accurate. In fact, I can remember looking out the Astrodome and seeing an aircraft not all that far from us, and there were the anti-aircraft fire comes along in a straight line. And I was looking at this guy, I think, if you don't move, alter your distance, your height, or whatever, you're going to get it. And he didn't, and he did get it, because it was extremely accurate. When you got to heavy ACAC fire, it's 20,000 and above. Yes, it was very heavy, but it was not quite as accurate. It was more mass pumping up shells at a given height.
And I take it with that raid, it was a relatively short duration, wasn't it?
That was a short one, yes.
And those operations at that stage, that was more tactical in a sense, was it, than strategic? How did you take to the first operation? Was it sort of an extension of the training in a way? I mean, obviously, I know you were looking out of the Astrodome, but other than that, was the actual nature of the operation, was it similar to what you'd done in the training?
No, it was. I think, like many others, prior to the actual flight, the bowel was quite active. But I think once you've done a number of operations, you don't get blasé about them, I'm sure, I don't know. But you're getting accustomed to the drill. And it's only then when you're getting near the end of them that you get back again to where you started.
when you do that, though, is a lot of the sort of, you know, you say about the active bowel, is that a lot to do with the waiting to get going, in a sense?
Yes, an anticipation of something that you don't know what it's going to be like. Once you've done a few of them, of course, you do know what it's going to be like.
And is it the case that once you get into the air, you're more or less fixated on what you need to be doing, so you kind of settle down?
Yes.
Would that be right to do?
Yes, you're involved in what you're doing, yes.
Can I take you through this sort of typical raid, in a sense, you know, from the preparations to what you actually do, to getting in the aircraft, to carrying it out, to return it?
Well, you had a general briefing, first of all the crews, and at one point then the senior officer draws back the curtain that shows the map and where you're going, followed by gasps if it happens to be a long way. And then you go to your individual briefings of wireless ops navigators, where they talk about when the times for when you expect you to listen out for your home station, and if you're going to be doing what was called tinseling, which was having a microphone was fitted into one of the engines, and then you could move your transmitter onto a frequency given to you and then press your button on your thingy, which sent a blast to the where the German chaps were sort of trying to vector their aircraft onto you. And that was one of the prime duties. And one of the pleasures of being a wireless op, there were two pleasures. One, the heating, such as it was best where the wireless op was. And secondly, when you were not listening out, which of course you were for quite a lot of time, when you were not, you could switch on to American Forces Network and listen to Glenn Miller.
So you would have your individual briefing. What kind of information would they give the wireless operator at that point? Or would they give you frequencies?
Yes, those frequencies that to listen out to. Of course, you on when you were actually in the air and going over Germany, you didn't send any messages. You were only listening. Because that's the important thing, listening, because after all, when you're on the way to a target, particularly if there was something went wrong and they wanted to change the target, if you're not listening, you go merrily on your own, which is not a good move.
So your issue there is to monitor any kind of signals that are coming in, and would that be then to pass it on to the probe of the pilots?
Well, if it, yes, for the pilot, yes.
So once you've received your individual briefings, what's the next stage then? I mean, what's the time of these occur before the raid?
Gosh, a lot depends on where the target is. I mean, if you're going to the Ruhr, we were talking then about, I suppose, 4 or 5 hours. But if you're talking about Dresden or Berlin or somewhere, then you're talking about 8 or 9 hours. So that does make some difference as to when you're going to take off to start. So having had your briefing and that, you have that great excitement, the flying meal, where you have food that civilians would be, think they're really lucky, eggs, bacon and things. We used to be a bit, I think our navigator, we were a bit unpopular. Found him a bit unpopular because he had a lot of peas and they really weren't very good for him, particularly for the first half hour flying. But we had a good meal. There were always various black jokes, like if you got an air crew who had done quite a lot of operations, and they were sitting at a table with another crew who were sprog, and knew it would not be uncommon for one of the those who've done a few trips to say to cross the, you haven't done much. Oh well, you made a tour. Well, if you don't come back, is it all right for me to have your meal as well as mine? So anyway. That's all part of black humour of forces, isn't it?
And would you then, after you meet, would you then go out to the aircraft?
Yes, the WAFs would pick us up in the truck and whistle us out to the aircraft, and some of those who were superstitious would then urinate on the wheels, which was something that was done. And then, we get in the aircraft, settle ourselves down and go through getting going.
So what kind of things would you have to do once you climbed into the aircraft? Would you set your frequencies? Would you organise yourself in a specific manner?
Yes. I would just switch the set on and see if the noises were coming in the right direction or whatever. And of course all the other members of the crew are doing the same with their pieces of equipment, because if there's anything that isn't working properly, that's the time you say, or the skipper have to get in touch with control and say, we can't go, if it was that bad.
And given the time of year that you started operation, you got into the winter months.
Yes.
What would you be wearing?
Well, I think, I don't know that it changed much between summer and winter. It might have done. We all wore long johns and all that sort of stuff underneath and stuff, and then sweaters and I'm trying to remember whether we had a one piece suit. I think we did. We had a one-piece thing we zipped into and did that with thick collar, a thick collars to it. Because it was something that, as I say, being in the fortunate position where I was seated, I was quite warm. I could have managed with less quite often. And the poor old rear gunner could probably have done with a lot more, because he used to get frosted up.
And would you wear gloves? Or could you operate without them?
No, I didn't wear... No, I had gloves, I didn't wear them. No.
What would you wear on your feet?
I just think I wore my ordinary shoes. Did I? No, I didn't. Beg your pardon. No, it isn't. They changed... Originally, the flying boots had been a sort of a suede thingy that... quite loose, actually. But they changed it to boots which had ordinary shoes, but stitched to it was this fleece that came up here. And the whole idea of that was, one of the problems was blokes who bailed out, either with the old ones, they came off, so they landed in bare feet, or alternatively, they did stay on, if they were trying to find some way to get away and join the underground to get them back. They were telltale boots you were wearing, whereas with the other ones, you just had a little knife in there and it would cut off the top, and you were left with a pair of shoes.
So you would prepare your position. I take it the rest of the crew would be doing their thing.
Yes.
And would you then have to wait for a time to take off, as such?
Well. Yes, I mean, you're taking off one at a time, and you take off fairly quickly, but you're following each other in fairly quick succession.
And how are you told to take off? Is that something that comes as a radio message, or...?
No, it would be from the control tower signalling to the pilot.
And once you've taken off, I was thinking, say, with a night-time operation, how do you proceed? Do you proceed, because at night I assume that you can't fly in a formation at all?
Well, no, but you're all eventually flying in the same direction if you're going to one particular target, and the navigator's got timings of where you ought to be at particular points. And the only other thing you've got, which the pilot would notice, is if you suddenly find yourself in a slipstream, you know there's another aircraft near at hand.
So you would fly in a bomber stream as such, would you?
As such, yes.
And so during that the flight, say, out to the target, your role again is to just monitor
mm-hmm.
frequencies and any messages that are coming in. Would it be the case that you would be likely to get many signals, or is it generally that you wouldn't receive much at all?
We don't receive much at all, no.
So if you did tend to receive something, is it usually...
It's something, well, yeah, it's some of importance, or it certainly could be, yes.
So how important is it then that, again, that silence is important, isn't it?
Yes.
For what reasons?
Well, because ground defences can pick up signals being sent.
So you're monitoring the set as that goes through. Now, I take it as well, in the position you're in, you can't see much of what's going on
no.
during that time. Are you close by the navigator? Is he in there?
The navigator's just ahead of me, sitting, looking that way, and I'm looking that way.
So you two are, in a sense, in that small... sort of bubble in the centre.
Yes, to the extent that, I mean, if, for example, particularly we're not on an operation, but if the navigator, and it did happen in training, was lost his way a bit, he'd give you a note, and you get a QDM and give him the note back of where you are.
Is that something that you're not able to do on operations, though?
Not really, no. You shouldn't be doing it. Not at all, no.
How do you communicate with the rest of the crew?
Well, we have the intercom. The wireless operator can cut himself off from the rest. He has to, because he's got the radio now. But otherwise, you switch into the intercom and then you talk to any of the other guys.
So is that like a ringman around the aircraft, in a sense, that you can talk to anybody you want? And how do you control the intercom? Is it so that you just literally...
Yeah, you can switch on and off. Mm.
Is there a procedure as well for using...
Not that I can recall, no. You just switch it on and say, hello, skipper, wireless op here, whatever.
Now, as you're obviously approaching targets or crossing the coast, there is anti-aircraft fire. What's the sort of sensation from where you are? Because you, as you say, you can't really see much, can you?
No.
So what's the sort of sensations that you receive as you're going through anti-aircraft?
Well, at night time, of course... If the anti-aircraft is relatively close, I mean, the aircraft bumps, moves up and down and sideways. If it's in the daylight, of course, I mean, wireless op has a little window here in which you can look out and you will see flak bursting.
And they, in the case of daylight operations, I take it you don't operate in a bomber stream there, would you operate more as a sort of squadron formation?
No, you generally have a stream as well. Unfortunately, of course, the RAF only started doing daylight raids in any number after D-Day, once we had occupied France. And one of the big problems was that whereas the Americans were accustomed to close formation flying, we were not. And so although we had a fighter escorts, and that they often had to cover a vast bigger area than the Americans were, because chaps tended to say, well, that guy is flying here, I think I'll fly over here. We were not quite so disciplined in that respect.
What about the approach to a target? Was there anything that would occur differently in the aircraft as you approached a target?
Well, the big thing is the bombing run. When you start on the bombing run, I can't remember whether it would be 5 minutes or might be less. It seemed like a long time. You then have to fly straight and level, regardless of the flak. And... that could be a bit hairy. Sometimes you would... I don't know how the Germans did it, but they had got their guns in some respects anticipating a direction into a target, and they'd put up a wall. They just kept firing AK between about 18 and 22,000, because that would be the area we'd be in. And if in daylight, you look at this and you think, how do you fly through that? A good many did, but some didn't. But you just had to fly straight and level. Once you'd gone through and bombed, of course, then you get the hell out of it.
Once that's happened, then, once the bombs have gone, is it a case of just getting away from the area as quickly as possible?
Yes, but obviously, particularly in the daylight... keeping together to a degree, because you've still got your fighter escort, which of course was it was a novelty for us, because it was the long range fighter was really quite a big event in the history of the aviation. Made a hell of a difference when suddenly you got, and also of course occupying France meant that many of the shorter range fighters could also act as escorts, because they could be based right up to the German border.
And given at the time when you started operations, how much was there a threat from the German Air Force at that stage when you were doing operations?
Not very much. I only think once on a night raid did we had a pass from a German. In daylight, yes, I saw a few. But there again, although the Germans had got the ME-262, which was reckoned to be the best jet aircraft of the war, they hadn't got many of them, and they hadn't got many pilots anyway. So they were there and gone in a flash. So no, they were not really. It was ACAC was really the big problem.
The return flight, is there an importance of remaining vigilant on your return flight?
Yes. Yes. Because some of the Germans did have chaps who would follow back, and particularly, of course, can catch them when they're landing, because you're a sitting duck then, of course. So that did happen. Also, if you had been badly damaged and you were losing height, then of course the wireless op very much came into his own in the, finding a place to land, if we could make the land.
Was that helped in the sense of, by that stage of the war, the advance of the Allied armies would give you more opportunities to get down potentially on the continent?
Oh, yes. I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, yes, if you're landing in, you're going to land in most, well, practically all of France was liberated, so you've got quite a big area there that if you've got big problems, you can get down probably somewhere. But preferably, if you can make it, you get back to the UK, because they've got more facilities there, because they were very rudimentary airfields in France.
What do you do when you land? What's the sort of procedure on landing there?
Oh, you go to a briefing where you are interrogated. And then you go and have your big meal again, and then according to the time of day, you either go and sit in the mess and have a rest, or you go to bed.
You said there was obviously a debriefing. What are they asking the crew there?
What's the basically their experiences, volume of defence you came across for the bomb aimer, how he saw the target and what did it look like, and did there appear to be a lot of damage there?
And would it be the case, when would you know, say you'd done a night operation, would it be usual for you to be not on the following night, or could you not tell, would you never...
You couldn't be 100% sure. There was a time, some period during the war, when blokes did go on consecutive nights, but I think it was not to be recommended, I would have thought.
So you would usually have a period of time?
Yeah, at least a day or two. I mean, I started in October, and I finished... I think I did one last operation beginning of March, I think. But I only did 28. You were supposed to do 30 for your first. But our skipper was on his second tour, so he finished at 25. And then our flight commander took us over, but he only had 3 to do. And they said at 28, oh, well, we'll let you off the last 2, for which there was no complaint.